You're listening to a special podcast from The Pod Delusion. In this lecture, you'll hear Mark Stevenson, the author of The Optimist Tour of the Future, talk about what we have to be optimistic about with some examples of the interesting people and technology in his book, and some that aren't in it. This was recorded at the National Museum in Cardiff as part of the British Humanist Association Conference 2012. To introduce the talk, here's BHA Trustee Blaise Egan.
Hello. My name's Blaise Egan. I'm one of the trustees, and I'm here to introduce Mark Stevenson. Now, you'll have looked at the blurb, I'm sure, and the thing that strikes you is the sheer diversity of what he's up to. Mark Stevenson is a future broker, best known for his critically acclaimed debut, An Optimist's Tour of the Future, and he's regularly asked to present at to present to both private and public audiences on matters of future narratives, institutional innovation, engineering serendipity, and learning. Some recent commissions include The Economist, the US National Space Symposium, and Oxford University. He also speaks regularly at schools, as well as the occasional rock festival. Outside of media work, Mark advises numerous investors on asset allocation, as well as acting as a special advisor to the Virgin Earth Collective, Primary Energy Research, and Everyone Mobile. He is co-founder of Learn Into the Curve, the UK's most respected learning consultancy. He's a fellow of the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce. He is NIB Master General at the Ministry of Stories, and founder of the League of Pragmatic Optimists, which sounds good, doesn't it? In his spare time, Mark is a comedy writer with two plays now in production. He says, "My aim is to put an optimism of ambition coupled with a pragmatism of approach back into the center of culture, and I'm trying to do that in every way I can think of." I give you Mark Stevenson.
Hello. Oh, that's rubbish. Hello. Oh, that's much better. Yes, excellent. Good. Psychologists at the University of Strathclyde have concluded that people may perform better at public speaking if they've recently had sex. So I'll apologise now. I want to start by showing you a couple of photographs. This is a typical ranchland farm in New Mexico, but it's typical of cattle farms you'll see all over the world. David was talking very compellingly about what's wrong with our farming and how much of that kind of land you need to support just one piece of cattle. That's the farm next door. Those two pictures were taken on the same day. These two farms have the same rainfall. The second farm, as you can see, is increasing biodiversity. It's also reducing its costs. It's increasing its yields, and it's sequestering thousands of tons of CO2 into the soil every year. And I'm going to return to these two farms a little bit later in the talk, because I think they say something very profound about how we approach the future. So, as you've heard... Oops, I did it the wrong way, didn't I? Sorry. As you've heard, we do have a few problems. Species extinction, energy crisis, economic meltdown, poverty, population growth, resource shortages, etc., etc. We've covered a lot of them so far in this conference. But the biggest threat to our future is, as David said, not that we have challenges. It's when we think we can't solve them. That's the biggest threat to our future. We've always had challenges, whether it was Hitler or smallpox, or today's biggest threat to culture, Justin Bieber. But we did beat Hitler, and we did eradicate smallpox, and we can indeed, with your help, do something about Justin Bieber. I did that talk recently to some religious people, and by accident I said we did eradicate small cocks. But strangely, all the women in the audience went, "Oh, that's a good idea, isn't it?" it's a great honour to be asked to speak to you and to follow such an awe-inspiring lineup. And I think the reason I've been asked to do that is because, my introduction said, I wrote this book called An Optimist Tour of the Future. Now, that's a title that surprised quite a lot of people, not least me, because I didn't intend to write a book with that title. When I originally pitched it to my agent, it was simply called A World Tour of the Future. It was a book I wanted to write to try and make sense, actually, for myself of what's going to happen in the next 20 or 30 years. You know, what is this biotechnology stuff? What is all this nanotechnology stuff? You know, where's the internet taking culture and society? What's happening with the climate? Can we do anything about it? Are the robots finally coming? Are we going back to space? And can Elton John be stopped? And other important questions about the future I wanted to answer. But the title of the book changed during my research, because during that 18 months of writing it, I came across so many opportunities for a much brighter future. And I have to say, that surprised me. It's also become something of a problem, though, because as soon as you associate yourself with the word optimism, most people think you're an idiot. They assume that you're some kind of rose-tinted spectacle-wearing buffoon who hasn't really understood the grand challenges that the world faces. So I have to say at the outset that my position is really quite simple, which is we should have an unashamed, and I mean unashamed, optimism of ambition about the future. And then we should use our best critical and creative skills to try and make those dreams come true. So have good ambitions and then work your nuts off to do something about it. Now, this is not new thinking, okay? This is what underpinned the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, it will underpin a lot of the Victorian age, but it's outside of culture right now. The idea of a human project of making the world better and doing something about it is actually slightly to the left of human culture right now. And actually, it seems a bit odd these days to even talk like this. You're seen as some kind of bizarre weirdo. But I like to say that the Renaissance needs a renaissance. So as part of my journey researching this book, I went to the Mojave spaceport. This is deep in the Californian desert. Mojave is not a great place to go. I don't recommend it. It's basically a one road with a train depot, a bunch of motels, and a Denny's where they serve the ultimate omelette. Well, that's a lie, by the way. It's not true. But it does have a spaceport next to it, and that was very entertaining. And the people there were particularly entertaining. I want to tell you about them. They're mostly from military backgrounds, because if you're in a spaceport, they're test piloting a lot of new aircraft or hardware. And so a lot of the people there are from military backgrounds. They're frontier-loving types. They hunt, they shoot, they fish, they swear prodigiously. Most of them are fiercely right-wing. They would regard Donald Rumsfeld as a bit of a wishy-washy liberal. Now, typical of their number was this man. This man is Dick Rutan. He's like the Bono of aviation. He's decorated in Vietnam. He's a brilliant fighter pilot. Got shot down in Vietnam. Crashed actually in the English countryside. He also crashed in the Arctic. Does crash a lot. he's perhaps most famous for flying this plane here. Obviously, that's a model. He didn't fly that. this plane here around the Earth on a single tank of gas without stopping. The Voyager aircraft. And whilst I was speaking to him, he told me something profound. And I want to share it with you. And I've written it down exactly in my notes here, because it's actually quite a subtle point. And I want to make sure I get the nuance and quote him exactly. So here we go. Stephen Hawking is a prick. Thank you. Stephen Hawking is a prick. You're telling me I can't go faster than the speed of light? Fuck you. Never look at a limitation as anything you ever comply with. Only look at it as an opportunity for greatness. Now, Dick also told me that what fighter pilots use for birth control is their personalities. Now, the first lesson here, of course, is never take Dick Rutan out for a drink with a physicist. The second lesson, however, I do take to heart, which is never look at a limitation as something you comply with. Only as an opportunity for greatness. I like that because it's in marked contrast to our public discourse. I mean, think about it. If I recall the story of the future I've been used to hearing since I was a boy, it goes something a bit like this. The future is not going to be very good. Especially if you vote for that guy. It's much better in the old days, wasn't it? Things are changing too fast. The generation below you are feral and dangerous and almost certainly on drugs and trying to kill you. Your job is at risk. You can't trust your neighbour, or what you eat, or your doctor, or your pension provider. Get your head down, try and buck the prevailing trend, vote for me, buy my paper. It's not very inspiring, is it? And what's worse, as I say, it seems pretty constant. I can't remember a time when I haven't been hearing some version of that. And so in this kind of context, this cultural context, optimism is seen as a kind of bizarre naivety. And I'm going to tell you why it's not. So when we think about the future, we tend to think about it in personal terms. Quite often, as we get older, we wonder how long we're going to live and how healthy we're going to be. Well, the good news is that we're all, generally, if you look at the world, as Dave was saying, living longer. In fact, I'm going to show you some interesting figures now, if I can get this to work. Oh, it always does this. This is very worrying. Sorry. I have to do that. There we go. Right. No. Why would you ask me that while I'm doing a presentation? And now I think whether I want to ignore or hide. Aren't they the same thing? I don't... Let's try... No! The wonders of technology. Exit full screen. Let's try this again. Right! This is a set of figures from the Karolinska Institute that's pulled them all together from all the world. Now, so each bubble represents a country. The size of the bubble represents its population. Now, and these, I'm going to run the world for the last 100 years. So we're starting in 1911. And what I want you to keep an eye on is here, the life expectancy. So first, quick question. What do you think the lowest life expectancy anywhere in the world was 100 years ago? You see, I should have asked that before I put that slide up, because now you can look. It was 22. Does anyone want to guess where that was? That average life expectancy, lowest average life expectancy in the world 100 years ago, 22, where was it? India. Actually, not close, but no cigar, actually Bangladesh. Okay. And I think it's Swedes up there who are living to about 58. So just keep an eye on that life expectancy curve, that axis, and let's just run next 100 years. So... So people gradually going up, there we go. There's obviously a few bits of bobs and strange things in the data there. That's China bumping up and down in 1 year. That's just an error in the data. There you go. This is what's happened the last 100 years in terms of life expectancy. Now, everybody's living longer, but what's more interesting is that the gap between rich nations and poor nations is a lot smaller. The lowest life expectancy anywhere in the world now, does anyone want to guess where that is? India again. You really don't like India. It's Zimbabwe? No, but they're certainly down there. It's actually Afghanistan. And for many of the same reasons as Zimbabwe, because it's nations that are sort of bedeviled by civil war and conflict that have the lowest life expectancy. But the lowest life expectancy is 44, which is double what it was 100 years ago. And at the top, I think it's the Japanese, I think they're living on average about 86 or something ridiculous. 83. So this is basically a public health miracle worldwide, isn't it? So even in Afghanistan, they're still living twice as long on average than they did in Bangladesh a year ago. And Bangladeshis now, I think, on average, are living to, I've got it here somewhere, 67. So at the bottom end of that, what's happening at the bottom end is dealing with child mortality. Dave was talking about child mortality. If you can stop children dying early on, that obviously the average goes up. At the top end, though, people are living really long. Some of that's to do with medicine. I'm going to talk about medicine a little bit later in my talk. Now, there was a lot of talk about population yesterday, and Dave touched it again. I'm going to say, well, it's very natural to worry about population growth. But actually, we are in the process of stabilizing the population. There's some long-term trends that mean we are going to stabilize. And what I want to show you is this. This the 2.1 here, that's your replacement rate. Look at all the countries to the left of it. If you go back 100 years, there wasn't a single country on that side of the line. They were all over there. So even though there are populations still growing quite largely in Africa, the trend is a reduction in the fertility rate. Worldwide, the fertility rate, as I say, has to hit 2.1 for us to stay stable. As at the back end of the 1950s, the world fertility rate was 4.62. As we entered this century, it got down to, I've got it here, 2.56. And today, it's 2.33. Okay? There isn't a single country in Europe that isn't that's replacing its natural population. So, there we go. Now, as you can see, Africa is a big problem. Now, the question is, On current projections, the UN's median variant estimate is will stabilise at 9.5 or 10 billion people. Median variant estimate, by the way, is a statistician's code for best guess. Two statisticians in the audience. Good. Now, we stabilise at 9.5 or 10 billion. That's great. And that's good, because nobody tells you that it's stabilised. They say, oh, we're going to have 10 billion people by 2050. And what we hear is, oh, my God, that means 20 billion by 2075. No, it means 10 billion at 2075, or probably less. If these long-term trends continue, so what is happening here? And one of the big trends that's happening is urbanisation. Back when there was 1 billion of us, only 3% of us lived in cities. And now I think the figure is 7 billion of us, and I think 52% of us live in cities. And all the population growth that's going to happen between now and that stabilisation figure is going to be absorbed by cities, plus some other people moving into cities. So cities are really important, because what happens is in cities is generally that women are more emancipated, have better education, access to all sorts of things that mean that they can't be abused as they have been in other areas. So cities are engines of female expansion and therefore have a downward effect on population growth. Now there are scenarios, of course, where for some reason the population, the fertility rate starts to rise in cities. But I can't see any convincing arguments to why that's going to happen. So I think we don't have to worry too much about population going rocketing. Those African countries will reach that point where they urbanise as they get more prosperous and will have a stable population. Okay. Now, but however, still 10 billion people is a lot, isn't it? Let's be honest. You wouldn't invite that many people around for dinner. So we certainly cannot, as David was saying, carry on thinking about having a sustainable planet with that many people if we carry on doing stuff as we have been doing it. And so we need to get a couple of reboots, or a number of reboots, in the way we think about the planet and ourselves and our history and where we come from. And my journey in writing the book was an exercise in those reboots. And one of those reboots is understanding a story. And it's a story that probably the people in this audience probably are more aware of than most, but it's a story that most people forget, because it's so big and so long that we just forget that we're part of it. And it starts here with the Big Bang. This obviously isn't a picture of the Big Bang. You can't get those. So this is merely a representation of the Big Bang, but I hope you forgive me. Anyway, as you know how this story goes, I mean, we've got Richard Dawkins in the audience, for God's sake. You know, basically it goes, you know, to the early Earth, amino acids, first cells, DNA. Simple multicellular organisms, complex multicellular organisms do this amazing thing. All of a sudden, they start forming communities, and then the organisms get really complex and forget things like this. If I do this, show this picture in a school, this is the point everybody goes, oh. Oh. Till we get an organism that looks a bit like this, and inside this creature's head is a society of cells that looks like that. And that gives rise to a whole new type of evolution, cultural evolution, the evolution of society through ideas. And like biological evolution, cultural evolution tends towards increasing complexity. Increasing complexity of human relationships, of trade, of technology, and so on and so forth. Until we get to the point where we have Shakespeare and shovels and Shanghai and Shakira and shampoo and share trading. And here we all are. So Richard Dawkins was entirely right that evolution is the new classics. It underpins everything about where we come from and where we're going. Where we're going, because a lot of people think this process is over. It isn't, unless you want to believe that Jeremy Clarkson is the pinnacle of human development. I'm going to show you a little bit of what comes next. This lucky lady is Caitlin McNamara. She's not lucky because she's being kissed by George Bush. That would be a stupid thing to say. She's lucky because she's one of the few people in the world to have had two bladders. The one she was born with, which was diseased and gave her all sorts of trouble, and the one she has now, which is a fully functioning, healthy replacement grown by cultivating her own stem cells in a laboratory, growing an entire new organ in the laboratory, and implanting it back into her. And she's not the only person now wandering around the planet with entirely stem cell-grown replacement body parts. This is her doctor, Anthony Atala. He runs the Wake Forest Institute of Regenerative Medicine in North Carolina, where they make things like bladders, but lots of other stuff as well. In fact, he's working on 22 types of human tissue right now. Anthony recently, well, last year, he's demonstrating a technique to print human kidneys. He did a TED talk, some of you may have seen, where he's testing out a clinical process where he can actually print a human kidney in 3 hours. He actually went on and said, basically, here's one I printed earlier. It was a fabulous sort of Blue Peter meets, you know, Dan Dare moment. It was fantastic. So, then we have the genetic revolution. First complete human genome sequence, as you can see. I think that was in 2001. Yes, 2001. $100 million. And that was layered on top of $3 billion spent by the publicly funded competing effort. There's a man in Harvard now called David White who reckons he can do a complete human genome for $30. And we know we can do it commercially for $3,000 now. So the $1 genome is not very far away. And then the 10 cent human genome is not very far after that. Ben Hammersley yesterday talked brilliantly and eloquently about exponential growth and Moore's law. And that law doesn't just apply to silicon chips, okay? It can apply to many other things as well. As you can see, in fact, here, the cost of genome sequencing is outstripping Moore's law roughly by a factor of four since the back end of 2008. That brings us to a very interesting place in medicine where we can start to sequence the genomes held in individual cells and compare them. And in fact, that's already been done by the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in Cambridge. They took two cells from a cancer patient, one that was healthy and one that had been ravaged by the cancer, and compared the genomes to see what had happened. And this takes us to a place where your diagnosis changes from, I'm sorry to tell you you've got cancer, to, you'll be pleased to know we've sequenced your cancer and we have a set of treatments specifically for you. Now, there's this lovely combination of what's happening in genetics and stem cell therapy. So there are some diseases that are genetically determined. They're in the blood. It doesn't matter. You can do whatever you like. You're going to get them. Huntington's disease is a good example. Huntington's disease killed Woody Guthrie. So it's a genetic disease. You know, you can change your lifestyle. You can take whatever drugs you like, but you're going to get it. Okay? This is genetic determinism, as unforgiving as Richard Dawkins in a Bible class. That's the only place in the world I can do that joke. So, Woody Guthrie, like most of the people who suffer from Huntington's disease, descended into death. He lost his ability to concentrate and coordinate, a particularly cruel end for a musician. It's incurable. Except maybe it won't be for much longer. Because that same team I talked about from Cambridge, along with some colleagues in other universities, what they did recently was they were able to take some stem cells from a liver which had a genetically determined condition, edit the genome of the stem cells to replace the code that was responsible for the disease with a fully functioning and healthy sequence, and then they grew those stem cells into healthy liver cells. So you start to see you can combine what people like Anthony are doing with what the Sanger Institute are doing, and suddenly the incurable starts to look curable. Kevin Warwick showed us some brilliant work about cybernetics. Don't know if you remember, but he showed us a chap called Campbell Aird, the guy with the artificial arm, which he was controlling with his other arm. And Kevin talked about how it would be great at one point we might get to the point where cybernetic limbs were actually controlled by the user's own brain. Well, here we have Robert Af Ekenstam, first recipient of this thing here called Smart Hand. Smart Hand is a robotic hand which has the same level of dexterity as your own hand. It's wired in to the stump that he lost his original hand to cancer, and it is indeed controlled by his thoughts. And it returns to him a sense of touch. He says, I can feel my fingertips, which is odd, because I haven't got any. Now, I don't want to get the geeks in the audience too excited, but this is basically the scene from the end of The Empire Strikes Back, where Luke Skywalker gets his hand back. In fact, they actually call that hand Luke. And I show Robert because he was the first person to receive this. This technology is now advancing quickly, and the hands are looking much more lifelike. I'm sure some of the sports fans in the audience recognize this man. Yep, Oscar Pistorius, the Paralympic runner who's been called the fastest thing on no legs. Now, some of you probably heard that Oscar has qualified, or reached the qualifying standard, for the able-bodied Olympics, which is interesting. But think about it. The technology in his legs is going to keep on doing that exponential thing that technology does, which means by 2016, Oscar, or one of his contemporaries, will be unbeatable by an able-bodied athlete. So he's not disabled anymore, he's enhanced. And athletics officials don't know what to do about that. In fact, they say he has an unfair advantage. So being born without lower legs is now an unfair advantage in competitive running. The point I'm making is the next stage of human evolution is upon us, right here, right now. But this time, it's self-directed. Human beings are the first species ever to take control of their own biology, and if they want, the biology of every other plant and animal on the planet Earth. And that is a very scary thought. In fact, a lot of people's reaction to that is we have to step back from technology. We must stop. In fact, I think I heard quite a lot of that in Greg's presentation yesterday. If they're religious, they'll say, this is not what God ordered. People worry that we're losing the essentially human in all this race with technology. Einstein said it. Einstein said, it has become appallingly obvious that our technology has exceeded our humanity. Einstein was wrong. Because trying to hold on to the essentially human by fighting against the thing that human beings do best, which has evolved through culture and technology, is futile. Whether we like it or not, this is one of our defining characteristics as a species. We make stuff, we invent stuff, and we do it faster and faster as the last set of inventions give us new tools to do things we couldn't have done without them. Okay? This is an important point. No other animal really does this. There isn't a bunch of doggists right now sat in Swansea listening to a doggy author talk about doggy technologies. Okay? That would be cool. But it's not happening. There's always two laughs on that slide. And yes, just for the super geeks in the audience, I do know that that make of computer did not have that level of resolution or colour. Please do not tell me that. Please do not tell me that after the presentation. And get out more. Okay. The point I'm making here is that the thing that people think is a threat to our humanity is in fact a wholehearted expression of it. And when you get your head around that idea, I believe it frees you up to think more clearly about your role in shaping the future. I spoke to a philosopher on my trip, a number of philosophers, a guy called Marc Bodeau was one of them, and he said, look, this change will come. And you can either try to stop it from happening, or you can ignore it. We can try to influence it in a positive direction. Trying to stop it from happening is futile, and ignoring it is simply irresponsible. Which means there is only one game in town, which is trying to influence this technological species in a positive direction rather than denying what they are. And that, I believe, is everybody's job. So whilst that first reboot is accepting and understanding that story, the story that gets us from the Big Bang to Oscar Pistorius, that's already built into history. You just have to understand that. The other things, the other reboots we need are things we have to do something about. And the first of those, of course, as David mentioned, is dealing with fossil fuels. Now, I'm going to talk about that from another angle. Okay? Polly Higgins yesterday talked about it from a legal angle. I'm slightly in love with Polly Higgins, by the way, now, I think. But I'm going to talk about it from a technological angle. So I'm very fortunate to sit on an advisory board of something called the Virgin Earth Challenge. This is Richard Branson's $25 million prize for any company that can, in an economically sustainable way, remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere at the gigaton level. Okay? 2,600 applications, most of them from mad people in jets. However, 100 of them had some merit. So a bunch of PhDs were duly dispatched to read through them. Actually, 50 of them really had some merit. And in September, 11 finalists are announced. I'm going to talk about some of them. The first one I'm going to talk about is this company here, Kilimanjaro Energy. Kilimanjaro Energy is based around the technology of this man here, Klaus Lackner. Lovely chap, German, now at Columbia University. And he's developed a machine full of this material here. This material here absorbs carbon. Okay, so if you put it in the air, it will saturate itself with carbon dioxide. This is not hard to achieve. Carbon, of course, being the slut of all the elements, it will bond with pretty much anything. That's why Mother Nature uses it as its preferred building block. Okay, that's why you're made of it. That's why most plants are made of it. That's why this stage is mostly made of it. Carbon, getting carbon or a carbon compound to bind with something else is not a problem. Okay, that bit's easy. The problem is, how do you make this economically viable? Because unless you can get that carbon off that material and reuse it, the economics of taking carbon out of the atmosphere become too expensive. Well, this is what's so great about this material, because this material will give the carbon dioxide back simply if you spray it with water. So Klaus has invented a machine where you stick a bunch of these carbon farming trees in the atmosphere, and they're 1,000 times more effective at removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere than a normal tree. You wait till they saturate, you take them inside the machine, you spray them with water, and the carbon dioxide bubbles to the top of the machine like bubbles in champagne. And Klaus has a prototype that he showed me of a shipping container-sized machine that he reckons 100 million of those would offset all our global emissions. 100 million sounds like a lot of machines, doesn't it? Until you realize we make 73 million cars every year. So if we can do that, we can certainly do that. But a lot of people will say, well, you know, yeah, but even if we take the CO2 out of the atmosphere, and this isn't the only thing, there are 11 finalists. Okay, I'm going to talk about another one later. So even if Klaus is wrong, there's at least 10 other people with severely compelling and commercially compelling options. But, you know, what do we do with all the CO2? Well, David conveniently mentioned that he's working on insulin. Well, some of you will probably know that most insulin now is generated by an E. coli bacteria eating sugar and excreting insulin. That's right, isn't it, David? Yes? Yep, good nod. Very academic nod, that I could hardly see. It was like a... No. It's like that secret, I'm really an evil genius, so I'm going to stroke my cat in a minute nod. You know, so thanks for that. That was really helpful. what's happened is an E. coli bacteria has had its genome modified so that it can produce insulin. Because before that, diabetics used to get their insulin from pigs, and there was problems with sometimes pig insulin, and also the pigs didn't really like it, to be honest. So it's much better to modify a bacteria to produce something useful. Now, if you're going to modify a bacteria to eat sugar and excrete insulin, can you modify life forms to do other interesting things? Well, of course you can, otherwise my talk would be boring. You could get them to do things like this: eat CO2 and excrete crude oil. Who's that? Who did that? My kind of lady. Okay. Sounds like science fiction? Not at all. That's what's happening right here in these ponds in New Mexico. Another one of the Earth Challenge finalists in the Earth Challenge. This is genetically modified algae that are using photosynthesis to talk to your question earlier. As their power source, and they're eating CO2, and they're excreting crude oil. And this is what the company is raising funds for to go and build next. This is an algae refinery that's on the drawing board at the moment. Now, currently, because their algae needs CO2, what is this company doing? They're buying it in truckloads, commercially, and shipping it in. And we thought that was stupid, so we said, well, why don't you go and talk to Klaus and a bunch of other people who think they can take it out of the atmosphere? Because if you can take it out of the atmosphere, that means you can put one of these anywhere on the planet. That's a carbon-neutral oil refinery you can put anywhere there's sunshine. How cool is that? Pretty cool. This is the kind of innovation that I live for. And I'm working with the Institution of Mechanical Engineers at the moment to get a research strand specifically into this area. And we reckon this is commercially viable in about 10 to 15 years. Now, what's so great about this is not just, you know, the economics of it, but suddenly you don't have to have things like this anymore. This Polly mentioned the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Geopolitically, things change, because you don't have to make friends with people like this. David talked about the world's first resource war. And when you fall out with people like that, you don't have to do things like that. And that saves an awful lot of money. So King also mentioned this study as well. Just think for a moment if just 10% of that money had been put into research into carbon neutral fuel. And where would we be? We wouldn't have needed to go to war. Not that I think we need to do anyway, but let's not get into politics because this is BHA. So, then of course, solar power. So, critics of solar power say solar power is like 1% of the generation of energy. It's a non-starter, it's a sideshow. Well, that's because they don't understand exponentials. Okay, solar power is reducing in cost at between 5 and 6% per annum, and it's increasing its installed base by 30% per annum. Take those two trends and extrapolate them 25, 30 years, it means we could do all of our energy requirements as they are projected using solar energy and cheap solar energy at that. I've got a bag at home with a solar panel on it that's made of carbon, which was printed on a big printer that used to be a Polaroid factory in New Bedford in Massachusetts. Even solar pessimists say that we'll have grid parity, the point at which solar is the same price as fossil fuels in some countries, within 10 years. And they are the pessimists. And they're wrong. So, clearly the geopolitical implications of what could happen to energy are massive. Polly showed us a slide yesterday. This one. And she very gently allowed me to vandalise it because there's actually something else we agreed that was in that came before resource depletion, and that was energy. Okay. Generally, what we're doing is we're looking for some form of energy. So I'm reading, and it's a management of that energy that is a real problem for us. We have to deal with the energy crisis. So I'm reading this very turgid academic book at the moment. That doesn't distinguish it from most academic books. Called this, The Collapse of Complex Societies by Joseph Tainter. Now, I think it was published in the 70s, but it's been republished 27 times. It's interesting, why is that? Well, he must be saying something pretty interesting. And what he says is he's come up with a theory of why complex societies like ours collapse. And he says it's all down to energy. So what happens when a society starts up is it starts up because it has access to some energy source, and it's able to do all sorts of other things, create buildings and have entertainment like Justin Bieber, things like that. But what happens at some point is the energy consumption of a society begins to outstrip its ability to produce it. And then what happens is that societies invest in bureaucracies to try and manage this decreasing resource or this gap. Rather, unfortunately, the bureaucracies tend to use up more energy than they save, therefore hastening the demise. And I looked at that thesis and sort of looked around at the world and kind of went, looks familiar. A good classic example of this is what happened to the mines. Okay, everybody knows the story. They kind of, just burnt all their wood, and that's what it did for them. But we're at a point now with some of the technologies I've shown you and some of the others where actually we may be able to engineer ourselves past that point without the collapse. We don't actually have an energy crisis. All we've got is an energy conversion crisis. And that's what we're in the process of solving. Now, technology is not always a solution. In fact, technology can often get in the way of a solution. I'm a big fan of critical thinking. And I promised I would return to those two farms I showed you earlier. In fact, David was talking about Australia as well. So it's nice linking in. It's almost like he knew what I was going to say. I'm driving through the Australian outback with my friend, my good friend now, Tony Lovell. And we stop at this paddock here. And as you can see, it's almost entirely bereft of vegetation. And when I visited Australia, the drought was 9 years long. They called it the Big Dry. And I said to Tony, well, is that the lack of rain? And he says, well, look down the fence. And then I saw that pattern everywhere I went in the Australian outback. Grass outside the fence, not much grass inside the fence. So clearly things can grow. But you can probably see that some of that grass is yellowing and dying. And Tony leans down, he picks it up, and indeed, it's dead grass, the yellow stuff. And he says, this is the other half of the problem. And to understand what's happening down the line of that fence, you need to go back in time to when our grasslands were dominated by huge marauding herds. There's a few places you can still see this, the Serengeti. In Serengeti, you have these huge herds of animals, they stick together as a defense against predators, and they go on this massive clockwise pilgrimage thousands of miles, always looking for fresh water and fresh grass. And that's important, because it's a key part of a relationship between grass and grazing animals that modern agriculture has completely forgotten about. You see, the growing buds of most grass plants are at the base. So if the grass plant gets too tall, it kills itself in its own shade. That was what was happening on one side of the fence. Now, in nature, an animal would have come along, eaten the tops off the plant, exposed the growth buds, and moved on. But the problem with the way we farm livestock is we split up those big herds, and we stick a few animals in a paddock and just leave them there. Now, cows are not long-term thinkers. They see a piece of grass, they will eat it right down to the base, and if it starts to grow again, they'll just go and have a go at it. So they effectively destroy their own food source if they're put in that situation. In nature, they just would have wandered off to something, oh, that's a bit greener over there. Okay? So that was happening down the line of the fence. Overgrazing on one side and undergrazing on the other side. And that's important for climate change because, as you know, plants are made of carbon. I think plants are 58% or 52% carbon, generally. And they're in balance above and below the soil line, like most plants, in fact. A tree root system is usually roughly the same size as a tree. And they have to keep themselves in an energy balance. So if an animal comes along and eats an inch off the top, then quite soon afterwards, the plant will lose an inch of its root matter into the soil. And that root matter is made of carbon, enriching the soil with carbon. Now, most of that carbon will rot and return to the atmosphere in the carbon cycle. But every time that happens, a small amount of stable carbon stays in the soil, enriching the soil with carbon. And as my friend Tony says, a little bit of a large amount soon adds up, because there are 3.4 billion hectares of grasslands on our planet. And if you increase the soil carbon content of those soils by 1%, and these farms are doing that and much more, you'd offset 11 years of global CO2 emissions. It's important to guess what the technology at the heart of this innovation is. Okay? It is the fence. Okay? What happens is, you do this. This is what a normal farm looks like. Well, this is my rather crude drawing of a farm, although I did have great fun doing it. What you do is, this is how a normal farm looks. So what you do is you simply get your animals into one big herd, as they would have been in nature. You build smaller paddocks, and you take them on a pilgrimage around the farm like that. Basically mimicking what they would have done in the wild. Anyway, it's a Serengeti on a farm. If you visit these farms, and I've visited many, actually you don't see many cattle because they're usually somewhere else. They're all in a big herd elsewhere. So most of the farm is empty of cattle all the time. And the result is things like this. Clearly you can see the difference in the farm using the technique and the farm that isn't. This is in Zimbabwe. That's one farm. That is the farm next door. This is near Victoria Falls. That is the farm next door. This is in Arizona, creek in Arizona, creek on the farm next door. I met a whole bunch of farmers using this method who were doing wonders for their business. The cost of production were down. They don't have to buy feed, they don't have to buy fertilizer. It's all completely organic, so they can sell their meat at a premium. I met one farmer using this method whose cost of production for a kilo of beef was 1/4 of the Australian national average, which means he can sell his meat at a profit for cheaper than his competitors can manufacture it. And it's sequestering loads and loads of CO2 into the soil. It's not that we have too much cattle, it's that we have too little grass. So you should relinquish meat from, as Dave was saying, from our traditional places, the way we're farming at the moment, but we should be encouraging this, because we've got a protein crunch coming. They've got those 10 billion people coming, most of them going to be in Asia, where the growth is. This is a very good way to feed them, calories very efficiently delivered. And also, soils rich in carbon retain a lot more water. An extra 1% of carbon in your soil accounts for an extra 150 gallons of water storage per hectare, which in a place like Australia is a big deal. Who do you think is the leading investor in this fabulous new technology, the fence? McDonald's. No, not McDonald's. Good guess, though. It is pension funds. Because pension funds want assets that are actually attached to something real, that have a predictable income, and that grow slowly in value over time. And that's what these are. It's a great irony now that my friend Tony has just raised $300 million from European pension funds to go and regreen a large part of New South Wales. So, what I like about the story, what I spent some time is it reminds us that even as we congratulate ourselves for our technical ability and our inventiveness, sometimes you just have to think a bit differently to solve a problem. Just maybe move a fence rather than invent another chemical fix. And yet you're probably all thinking the same thing I was thinking, which is, why is the farmer next door not doing this? Right? No, seriously, I mean, he can see, can't he? He can see literally down the line of the fence the difference between his fortunes. He's probably living on drought assistance from the Australian government, and a lot of farmers out there are committing suicide because of rural hardship. And the guy next door is prospering. His stocking levels are going up. He's making money. He's picking up the girls in the local bar. It's fantastic. I met one guy using this technique who sold all the equipment. He bought a failing farm, sold all the equipment, bought a bunch of fences and a couple of motorbikes. And every morning he gets up, gets on his motorbike, drives to a paddock, opens a gate, watches a bunch of cattle wander through, closes the gate, and he drives to the pub. He said, I get really tired watching my neighbours. They seem so busy. So why is his neighbour not doing the same thing? I said, this attorney, what's going on here? He said, ah, these are special Australian fences. They are impervious to ideas. Which leads me on to the next reboot that we need, because far too many of our governments and our corporations and our NGOs and our schools and our academic institutions act like the neighbouring farm. They have their version of the idea-proof fence, but it's not a fence. It's called rules and procedures and expectations of how the world should work that were born in the Industrial Revolution. You see, when we talk about innovation, we happily reference technology, medicine, even art, dance, fashion. We don't have a problem with innovation any time. There's more processing power in this thing here than there was in the entire Apollo space mission. We don't have a problem with innovation, except when it comes to the way we organise our institutions and our corporations. It's a distinct irony to me that every new Prime Minister or President stands up sometime in their first term and does a rousing speech about how to support innovation and entrepreneurship. And then you say to yourself, well, when was the last time you innovated in the way that democracy works? Anybody know? Yes, interesting, isn't it? None of us can remember. Well, actually, arguably it's 1928 was the last innovation, which is actually not really innovation. It's simply that in this country we gave women the vote. Okay. So we actually gave just more people access to the same system that by then was already out of date. I find it very insulting when ministers talk to me about innovation. But we're going to see a radical shift. Things are going to change. What's happening in biotechnology and nanotechnology is going to change the way society works. And as Ben quoted William Gibson, and I'm going to as well the same quote, because it's actually, as futurists, it's actually in our code of practice. You have to quote William Gibson at least once in every talk, otherwise, you know, you're kind of disgracing your profession. Now, the quote was, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed yet. Very famous quote. In fact, I opened my book with it. And why is it not evenly distributed? It is simply because even though we have this fantastic new technology and new ways of thinking and understanding, we still have these expectations about what a school should be, what retirement should be, what an organisation should be, that hasn't changed for 150 years. And therefore, the future that we need is not going to happen unless we change our minds to meet it. And changing minds is the hardest thing to do. So when I work with companies. So companies often phone me up, or organisations, they phone up and say, Mark, we'd like to be more innovative or more green or more humane or more ethical, which is good. I mean, they don't phone up and say the opposite. That would be really weird. We'd really like to be less humane. Can you come and help us? They phone me up and they say these things, and I, you know, you kind of think, well, do you really? So I've got this test now to discern between the organisations that want innovation and the ones that want innovation wash, which is the appearance of innovating without actually innovating. And the test is simply this. I sit down with the team that's invited me in and I say, great, how many rules can we break? Very rarely the CEO will say something like, as many as we need to within the law. More often than not, what happens is this. Everybody looks at each other as they're looking for permission for something. And then their shoulders sink a little bit as if something inside them is slowly dying. And then somebody, usually from the legal department or human resources, says something like this. Well, Mark, you see, we've got these processes and procedures. In fact, we'd love you to read this company manual. And we spent an awful long time embedding these processes and procedures in our company. And it costs us a great deal of money as well. But we really do think that these processes and procedures embody a spirit of innovation. So would it be okay if we innovated in that context? Laughs of recognition all around. The answer is, of course, no. It's like trying to run 100 metres in bunny slippers. You look stupid. More importantly, your competitors will be dots in the distance. Is it any wonder that so many of us feel hampered when trying to make a different future from the past, when we're faced with that every day in the places that we work? Ben referenced Marshall McLuhan, who said, you know, we shape our tools and then they shape us. It's not just our tools. Our schools and our corporations now shape the way we work and think far more than we're shaping them. We are in a full-on battle with industrialism and the mindset of it that we have to break and we have to win if we're going to win the future. So the rules that we're all being told to live by are now there to be broken. Now, I'm not suggesting all rules are to be broken. There are some very sensible rules. If you see a Justin Bieber record, throw it in the bin. Sensible rule. Okay. But there are some rules that need to be broken. I'm going to tell the story of my favourite rule breaker from history. And I got this story from my very good friend, Michael Brooks, who wrote this book. And it's the story of this man. And that book's brilliant. It's full of stories like this. So this is Werner Forssmann. And he has almost certainly saved the life of somebody you know, and probably somebody in this room, because Werner Forssmann was the first person to pioneer the technique of cardiac catheterization, which is now the standard technique for getting some drugs or a camera into your heart or opening up a valve. It's not very pleasant, quite frankly. They make an incision, sometimes nearly groin. They push a tube up and get it into your heart. Not nice. Saves your life there. So good. Now, back in 1929, when Werner came up with this idea, the accepted wisdom was you couldn't touch the human heart without killing the patient. And he'd seen vets touch animal hearts and thought, well, no, I think you can touch the heart. That may not kill the patient. So he went to his bosses at the hospital he worked at the time. He was quite a young man. He said, I'd like to try this cardiac catheterization thing on one of our heart patients. And they went, no, you're crazy, go home. You'll kill them. He said, okay, look, just give me a patient that we know is going to die anyway. And the worst that can happen is I'll just kill him a bit earlier. They said, no, Werner, go home, you're nuts. He said, all right, look, I'll do it on myself. They went, the ethics committee will go bonkers. You are not doing that. Go home. So Werner did the only thing that a reasonable physician could do, which was he decided to seduce the chief nurse. Why did he do this? Because Gerda Ditzen, as she was called, had the key to the cupboard with all the surgical equipment he would need to do that procedure on himself. And so in his autobiography, he states, I started to prowl around Gerda like a sweet-toothed cat around a cream jug. It says Germans aren't romantic, eh? Anyway, actually, they got on very well. So her being the chief nurse, she was naturally very interested in medicine and surgery, and they actually became very good friends. And when he had gained her trust, he gave her his big idea. Said, I want to try this cardiac catheterization thing. And she said, not only will I give you the key to the cupboard, I'll be your first patient. Do it on me. So a few nights later, they sneak into the hospital where they both work, and Werner ties down Gerda to the operating table, and he starts to tap her arm with some iodine to make an insertion into the brachial vein, and then he leaves. He leaves her tied up, because he doesn't want to hurt her, he just wanted the key to the cupboard, and he goes into the next room and starts to perform the procedure on himself. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried self-cardiac catheterization. It's not easy, especially if you're the first person in history ever to try it. And he had a great difficulty in getting the tube all the way up to his heart. And he thinks, I'm going to need some help to get it this final distance. So he goes back into Gerda and says, can you help me? She's furious, by the way, at this point. But nonetheless, she calms down. He unties her. And she does indeed help to push the catheter, they think, all the way into his heart. Okay, great. Let's get down to the x-ray room and take an x-ray of this. Because if we can take an x-ray, prove it works, then we're golden. So they run down to the... Well, they don't run down. They hobble down to the x-ray room. And they are confronted by another one of their colleagues, a man called Peter Romius, who was working in the x-ray room. And Peter saw what was going on, was horrified, and he immediately tried to pull the catheter out of Werner's arm. So as you can imagine, is not pleasant. Werner, being a reasonable physician, did the only thing a reasonable physician could do in this point, which he decided to kick Peter really hard in the testicles, repeatedly. And Peter obviously desisted quite quickly and ran off to get reinforcements. In the intervening period, Gerda helped Werner take that x-ray. And here it is. And you can see the catheter going all the way into his heart. Werner Forssmann won a Nobel Prize for that x-ray. I would like to remind you, this is a Nobel Prize won by breaking all the rules, seducing a colleague, and kicking another colleague in the testicles. Now, the reason I tell this story is because I want to ask you, what do you think any of us would have done if we were Werner's boss? Because most of us would have said no. It's very hard to give yourself permission to make mistakes. It's even harder to give the people who work for you permission to make mistakes. And why is that? It's because we've grown up in a culture where making mistakes is just about the worst thing you can do. We've stigmatized them. I work with companies where natural innovators have been called losers because they made some mistakes at one point. Corporations take what's left of your creativity and they crush it. I'm with Ken Robinson here. I'm not saying making mistakes is the same as being creative. He says, but if you're not prepared to make a mistake, you'll never do anything original. It's one of the ideas of industrialism. You specialize, specialize, specialize till you never, never make a mistake. And that's not what we need for the world that's coming. Now, Edison pointed this out. He said, I didn't come up with one way to make a light bulb. I came up with 3,000 ways not to make a light bulb. Even Keith Richards understands this point. He was asked, how do you come up with those amazing riffs, Keith? He said, well, I just start playing until I make the right mistake. It's an important point. Here's a man who's optimistic he's going to get something wrong in the creation of something brilliant. Scott Adams, who does a Dilbot campaign, says creativity is making mistakes. Art is just knowing which ones to keep. So the point I'm saying here is that if we're not embracing that questing disposition, if we're not willing to make mistakes and give the people who work for us the permission to make mistakes and our children permission to make mistakes, then we're going to struggle. If we're not smashing ourselves into new ideas, if we're not doing the exact opposite of what the Industrial Revolution asks us to do, which is specialise, specialise, specialise to the point we can't even talk to the person in the next office. We're on a full-on battle, as I say, with industrialism, and we have to beat it. And now I'm going to talk about the final reboot that we need. It is the most important, and it is the most personal, and it is probably the hardest. And that is dealing with cynicism. Because cynicism has become embedded in our society and is seen as wisdom. There's nothing likable or even clever about cynicism. For the cynic, everything is just a little too hard to imagine and therefore a little too hard to do. How can you make a better world if you can't imagine it's possible? Cynicism, I like to say, is a bit like smoking. You may think it looks cool, but it's very bad for you. And worse than that, it's bad for the person standing next to you. And yet, it's so easy, isn't it? I find myself being cynical every single day because it's been bred into our culture. Every single day I find myself saying, that guy's an idiot, he'll never make that work. Here's the 10 reasons why it won't. Or who am I to try and change the world? Who the hell do I think I am? But I have learned that cynicism is the ultimate enemy of getting anything done and is therefore the ultimate enemy of the future. And for me, it came down to one final principle, which is you've got to stop judging yourself by what you own, and you have to start judging yourself by what you create. So, in closing, I'd like to say I think we're actually entering a really incredible time at the moment. I was recently interviewed by a newspaper, and they said to me, why is futurism suddenly back in vogue? Which I thought was an interesting idea. The idea of futurism having a renaissance was quite funny. I said, I didn't know it is. But if it is, it's probably because the future is up for grabs in a way it hasn't been for a long time. Because we can see right now, all of us can see, that our systems that we're using to organise ourselves are no longer fit for purpose. We can no longer paper over the cracks of our financial system, our legal system, our education system. Okay? But at the same time, all these incredibly powerful new tools that are catalyzing each other, nanotechnology, biotechnology, information technology, and the things that means for humanity and our morals, the things like, you know, what's happening with Robert F. Eckenstein with that robotic hand, what can happen to people with previously incurable diseases or replacement body parts. These incredible new tools are coming online. So for a first time, we know we've got to change, but maybe we can with our ingenuity. And so I was asked by the same journalist, well, what will the world look like in 50 years' time? And I said the same thing that Paul McCauley said yesterday, which is it's very futurists shouldn't make predictions. If you look at the history of futurism, most of the predictions told you a lot more about the particular prejudice of the futurist in question or what was happening in culture at the time. I find it really funny when I read sci-fi novels from the 60s that so many of them are basically Russia and America having a fight on the moon. So I try not to make too many predictions, other than the fact that Justin Bieber's next record will be awful. Now, but what I did say was, is this, I said, look, the future we have will be defined by the values we choose. And it may be we're reaching a point in history where those values will not necessarily be defined by the constraints that we face, because we can solve the energy crisis, but by what we are prepared to dream. But if those dreams are not dreams of compassion and humanity and justice and sustainability, then we better be prepared for the consequences. Which is why it's so delightful to be with this audience. Because what that says to me is that humanists are a disproportionately important group, and we've become more so. Because you embrace the mindset we're going to need if we're going to win the future of humanity and critical thinking. So well done. There's a Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. I don't think it's a curse. I love living in interesting times. The future is up for grabs. And you people in this room with the mindset that you have are some of the people who realize more than anybody else that you don't need anybody's permission to go and be brilliant and make the world better. And in closing, I would just say, if I have one piece of advice, it is to remember what Dick said, that a limitation is not a problem. It's only an opportunity for greatness. Thank you for listening.
That's it. If you'd like to hear a regular weekly program, just head to poddelusion.co.uk. There you'll also find the other talks from the BHA 2012 conference, including Sir David King and Ben Hammersley. Thanks for listening.